Have you ever covered a carpet stain with a rug, ignored a leaky faucet, pretended your half-painted living room is supposed to look like that? Well, you're not alone. We've all got unfinished home projects, but there's an easier way. When you download Thumbtack, it's easier to care for your home from top to bottom. Pull out your phone and in just a few taps, you can search, chat, and book highly rated pros right in your neighborhood. Plus, you'll know what to tackle next, because Thumbtack is the app that shows you what to do, who to hire, and when. So say goodbye to all those unfinished home projects, and say hello to caring for your home the easier way. Download Thumbtack and start a project today.
Welding instructor Alex DeClaire knows VR training platforms like ForgeFX help students master their skills.
There's a big learning curve with welding. Virtual reality simulates that exact muscle memory that they need.
Learn more at meta.com/metaverseimpact.
We're coming, and we ain't backing down.
We don't need a bunch of cats in here. Yeah, looking in the mirror.
Everybody just do your job! Just
stay next! Hey, will you shut up?
I'm bitterly disappointed with the officiating today.
Guys being dudes.
And they run through our like through a tin horn, man.
Thank you, Lee. Alex Kirshner, Stephen Godfrey, I am Richard Johnson. Folks, our long national nightmare is over. We have found a way as Split Zone Duo LLC to get over what has been probably the most trying business reality of our time. For our YouTube audience, over the last few weeks, Stephen Godfrey has for some reason had these ridiculous emoji reactions on his screen throughout the show. You've heard us reference it. I think we socialed it in one clip. You can go to the last few shows that Godfrey's been on and see it. Tech support Alex Kirshner, Geek Squad Alex Kirshner, moments before the show, arresting the slide and fixing it. It's one of the most clutch plays in podcast history.
Wow.
From my seat.
In my defense, this has plagued people at like major cable networks on live television. It got Mero this week. All right. He was doing a podcast from Desus and Mero. R.I.P.
R.I.P.
It has been a ubiquitous problem. And I was told that the adjustment to fix it that Alex just gave me was a new update in OS X. I just looked that up because wow. I was like, well, how? Like, it was a very simple sort of like toggle on, toggle off. Here, let's see if it works. So what I would do is I hold the microphone because it makes me feel more comfortable to do that. And I would put my thumb up like this, and that's what started the whole thing.
Oh.
I don't know what triggered the balloons, which is the one in my Twitter avatar now.
You never got the fireworks though, right?
I never got fireworks. I would get balloons and thumbs up constantly. Sometimes when we were talking about like sort of sensitive material or just sort of inappropriate.
Can you, somebody listening to this podcast, this is a service, by the way, because somebody listening to this podcast, I guarantee, has had this happen to them in a Zoom call. Alex, can you quickly run through the tech support issue that you solved here?
Yeah, there's a little camera thing on Mac at the top of your screen on your toolbar. You click it, you see reactions, you uncheck all the reactions. Easy, easy peasy. But to me,
apparently it was not always that easy.
To me, this was very funny and I wanted it to continue as long as it was happening to Godfrey. But when it happened to me, I felt like it was time for us to make the fix.
That's when it became an international incident.
Yeah, I would agree.
The reason why it was happening to me apparently was I bought a new MacBook a couple weeks ago. And excuse me, it didn't like. I guess it was updated OS or something like that. But yeah,
Godfrey, how many
for a
years
while, I was like lean into?
How many years you go between like getting new MacBooks? Like, what's your
depends on
rotation?
It depends on if Vox Media owns the MacBook or not.
It's an interesting issue. Yeah,
because Sports Illustrated owns this one.
See, I'm working
There's your real answer.
I'm working on about 4 years right now on mine. And it's starting to get onto its last legs. But the thing is, I like to think that I could get at least 5 to 6 out of this bad boy. I mean, it served me well. I take care of it. I monitor it all the time for malware, for all of the, I do the diagnostics. Like, I'm trying to keep it 100, but we're going to see. We're just going to see. Should we do some awards?
We should. This is College Football Awards Week. The most prestigious awards are not the National Football Foundation College Football Hall of Fame awards going on in Vegas. It's certainly not the Heisman Trophy Awards here in New York City this weekend. And it ain't whatever ESPN's doing, I believe, Thursday night when they do the Biletnikoff, the Maxwell, the yada, 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 et cetera. Folks, it's the second annual Splitty D's. I mean, dozens and dozens of people have been clamoring to know what this year's Zonies were going to be, what this year's Splitties were going to be. We still have top minds at work trying to figure out what the best name is for these things. But we here at Split Zone Duo have our own awards because, of course, we do.
Yeah, the Zonies.
Why is it so weird when you name things?
The Zonies are not designed to be.
I don't like any of these names.
The same as the awards that get doled out on TV. You know, they're awards in our style that are designed to commemorate things that we think are interesting, are noteworthy from the college football season, such as the very first one on our list, which is the Power Five Team of the Year. That is not necessarily the best team. They're going to settle that on the field. Sorry, Florida State, minus Florida State. They're going to mostly settle it on the field.
I don't know that they are, Alex.
It is not necessarily the best team or the most deserving team, but it is a team that did something that we liked the most that we are now especially interested in going forward from the Power Five ranks first.
Or is it best? Or is it the best of the most deserving?
Most deserving is not even in our lexicon, Richard. We never think about that.
I'm just going to go ahead and let the listener slash viewer know because your pal here has been on planes all week. I will simply be it'll be a little bit like me in real time listening to the Hurry Up.
Yeah, just bring it off. You
guys are going to give your picks, and then I'm just going to decide which one I like better.
All right, that's fine.
Or throw a wild card out there. Just absolute make it up, turn the homework in last minute.
It's like the Oscars that one year when they gave it to the one movie and then came back and gave it to the other movie. The best picture.
Moonlight and La La Land.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was something.
I'm a man of culture.
Richard, Power we'll 5 Team of the Year. Movie. Kick us off in the 2023 Zonies. Go ahead.
I'm actually going Louisville here. Before Kentucky ruined their season at the end, which Lord knows that was going to happen, Kentucky was this year's ACC team that could plausibly make it to the playoff, but nobody actually thought they were going to make to the playoff. It was North Carolina last year. It's Louisville this year. And Louisville made a run. Jeff Brohm is like final boss Louisville man, their head coach. I mean, he grew up there, played there. Family is like high school football royalty. You know, we didn't do I can't remember if we did the one coach is definitely going to work thing. He was the one where everybody was like, oh, yeah, that at least makes the most sense why they did it. Made the most sense why they hired him. It's one of those things where you could tell he'd been angling his whole life for the job, and he gets in the job, and they were pretty good this season. I mean, they absolutely roasted Notre Dame earlier in the season when I thought Notre Dame was playing pretty well. Were they the best team? No. They weren't able to beat Kentucky, obviously, and they weren't able to beat Florida State at the end. But deep into November, we were having a plausible conversation about this Louisville team, and they played a very entertaining game against Miami in November as well. My splitty for Power Five Team of the Year goes to the Cards.
You know,
Alex,
I want to make a note about Richard's pick. I think it's a solid pick. I think if the ACC championship game laid something bare about that team, it was that, like, damn, they did that with Jack Plummer at quarterback, you know?
Yes.
The young man is a perfectly fine college quarterback, but he is not the sun, the moon, and the stars. And that was demonstrated by what Florida State did to him in Charlotte. Yet, to engineer a significant year one offensive turnaround, if you're Louisville, especially with that quarterback situation, they went from 70th to 41st in offensive SP plus, a very sizable jump, one of the bigger jumps in the country. Impressive, Richard, a solid pick.
They also had like one of the best edge rushers in the country in Ashton Collette. So,
yeah, and defense has been the better side of the ball for Louisville for a couple of years. It was the better side of the ball at the end under Scott Satterfield as well. I'm going with kind of a split pick here for the Splitties. Two teams that are kind of in a similar weight class to each other and to, in my opinion, Louisville. It's the Can You Do It Again division of Mizzou and Arizona.
At the end of this spiel, you are going to have to pick one.
Okay.
Don't split the baby.
It's not allowed.
I'll pick one at the end. Let's go through our process then. I think both of these teams found fun formulas on offense. Zona found two quarterbacks. One, Nofavita, turned out to be better than the other, Jaden Delora. had two really good premier wide receivers, Ted Aroa, McMillan, and Jacob Cowing. And what I found so impressive about Arizona was that they pull off this, you know, kind of dreamy comeback season where Jed Fish almost puts them in the New Year's Six bowl games, you know, a pretty narrow miss in going 9-3, 7-2 in the pack. While they're, you know, on the heels of their roster being the site of a shopping spree in the portal for other teams last summer. USC, I've mentioned this before, just kind of went through Arizona's roster and just grabbed and grabbed and grabbed. I mentioned the two great wide receivers. There was another one, Dorian Singer, who was probably the best receiver on the team a year ago, who was gone to a conference opponent. Fat lot of good at him. Yeah, fat lot of good at did USC. But really up and down the roster, I think Arizona had a ton of turnover over the course of the last offseason and still managed to stay robust on offense and go from absolutely horrendous defensively, which they had been, to perfectly fine on defense. And you see sort of a junior version of like what has to happen for USC, for instance, to be good when they get to the Big Ten. It's like, well, you know, keep your offense at a level where it's one of the best in the country and just be fine on defense. Just figure out how to be fine on defense. And I commend Arizona for figuring out that part of the game this year. It's a pretty important part of the game. And Missouri, I think, you know, a somewhat similar formula in that the offensive skill position guys were just fantastic all year. Brady Cook took a big step forward. They had a couple of great receivers. I like to talk in particular about Luther Burden and Theo Weiss, who I got to see in person when I was down in Athens, and who I think are both Sunday players, really terrific athletes from Mizzou. Cody Schrader, one of the best running backs in the country, a nice answer to Jonah Coleman over in the Arizona half of the splitties here, and stayed solid on the defensive side of the ball, despite not having like the big star that Mizzou has occasionally had defensively at different junctures over the last 8-10 years. I think the question with both of these teams is, what will this year be worth to you? You know, in Mizzou's case, they still got a New Year's Six bowl game to play against Ohio State. I'm excited to watch that one. Normally, I would look at both of these teams and say, ah, big things coming in 2024. The question is, what will your roster be? And I've kind of given up the ghost of trying to figure out what rosters are going to look like in September, in December, because Lord knows there's just no way to predict. Like, there's a lot of eligibility left among those guys I just mentioned on those teams. And will they be playing for Mizzou and Arizona next year? I hope so. I have no idea. Godfrey, I'm going to let you break the tie. Arizona.
No. You have to pick one. You haven't picked one yet.
Yeah, I have to pick Louisville against whoever you're going to pick.
Okay. No, I like that. I like that. I nominate Mizzou because they still have a chance to beat Ohio State.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, so, that game. Yeah. Okay. All right. Here's the deal. I was going to pick Louisville anyway, here's why. I think the instant effect of hiring the right coach for the right job, I think Satterfield maybe didn't get quite as much attention as he deserved for a decent roster building process. The problem was it was never a complete process in Louisville. Bringing in the native son so often backfires. Like, we've talked cautionary tales about dream jobs. That's only been a year. It's only been a year. But there's nothing that's happening at Louisville right now that doesn't make me feel like it couldn't be maintained above the standard that was set previously under Satterfield. Arizona, I feel like, it'll be turbulent for them. And I know this isn't an award that necessarily judges next year, but I like the idea of this sort of setting the table for the next couple seasons. Missouri is a really close pick, Alex, only because wasn't Eli our number two hot seat pick?
Yeah.
Even
like literally
one.
Neil Brown. I will say that when people kicked it around this summer and said, who's going to get fired? Like, someone has to get fired in the SEC because someone always gets fired in the SEC. Everyone was like, well, it'll probably be Eli. So to that end, to finally have it come together and coalesce and also not have a Luther Burden transfer issue occur, which was really close to happening, I still want to give a slight edge to Louisville. It's a really good pick. My minor suggestion would be a little school called SMU that will technically not be a Group of Five school very soon. It beats Tulane in the American. They had a close loss with Oklahoma. They were not as, I think, prepared functionally in terms of what they had when they had it. Also, TCU declined a little bit down the season. They lost to TCU, and then they beat everybody else. So, good for SMU. It's a team we haven't talked to. It kind of has that Louisville-itis a little bit. Like, we haven't really talked about SMU that much this year as they go into the ACC. Rhett Lashley signed an extension. Like, they're going to be a salty offensive team to watch. And God knows they have the money. It's SMU.
All right.
Godfrey, so the Splitty D goes to Louisville for the first one. We will
bring,
we'll bring the drum roll back for the next category. Our live orchestra is despondent right now that they weren't able to play. But Godfrey, who are you wearing tonight?
Man, you would say this tonight. I'm wearing a black long sleeve t-shirt that was in the bottom of my bag. I did not pack home field. Connor, please don't get mad at me.
We'll get to our home field.
I had one compressed carry on. I went from a literal tropical environment where I was at a wedding to the very, very cold Northeast in one carry-on bag. And so I didn't bring a hoodie with me. And I actually thought I had a home field hoodie where I was going. And I don't.
I got a carry-on recommendation for you. We'll talk about it offline.
I have a great carry-on strategy. You don't have three kids. So whatever amount of time and thought you put into anything, you need to minimize that by about 75 to 85%.
Okay.
And then also don't sleep.
Shout out to Monos. The Splitty D for group five.
Shout out to Birth Control.
The Splitty D for group of five team of the year. Again, not necessarily the best team, as Alex said earlier. Team that did something that you really liked. UTSA. Shout out to the Roadrunners. Roadrunners come in with a truckload of injuries early in the season. Frank Harris's body is broken, seemed broken beyond repair earlier in the season. Yeah. In the offseason and earlier into this season, they got everybody back and did what I think we expected them to do in this new league, which is come. I think we thought they were going to win it, but they got obviously a game away from playing in the conference championship game. They lose to a Tulane team that's really good. There ain't no shame in that game, but they kept the coach too, baby. They kept the coach. So trailer for another year. We're running it all back at UTSA, and we move. We'll see if Baylor opens next year. But for now, UTSA is my group of five team of the year. On my ballot, they edge out Liberty. Liberty also obviously the best group of five team of the year per the College Football Playoff Committee. They are going to let Liberty play Oregon in the Fiesta Bowl. I don't think we've talked enough about the Libs and their insane rushing offense. It's the best rushing offense in the country.
Like, yeah, I mean, we did a bit on conference championship weekend about it. They led all, I think, the entire nation at one point in rushing, and then I think they were top three in the nation in turnover margin interceptions. That's pretty easy way to win football games.
Jamie Chadwell really is add water instant, like rushing offense. It's pretty insane.
He is
the. Yeah, Roadrunners drop off a little bit on defense, I think. But, you know, at the end of the day, UTSA has and had enough offense to get the job done all season. That's why they are my pick for Splitty D G5 Team of the Year.
Yeah, Liberty's a pretty good team. No one is pretending that they're not a pretty good team. I think what is interesting about them is that for the second time in... three seasons? Yeah, because Malik Willis left after 2021. They just, you know, went into the portal and found a quarterback who, for whatever reason, for God knows what reason, was available to them. And, like, why was Malik Willis available to Hugh Freeze? I don't know. Why was Caden Salter available to Jamie Chadwell? I don't know. I think what we need to do, right-thinking people in this country, is stop letting some of the best quarterbacks in the country just fall into Liberty's lap, because, like, there are better places to play college football, but Liberty continues to wind up with just, like, incredible college football players at the most important position on the field. What are we going to do about that?
Interruption.
Are you done with your argument?
Actually, Salter transferred in 2022, so he was under Freeze. So Hugh Freeze is the gift that keeps on giving to the Liberty Flames. My group five team of the year is UNLV. UNLV had a season that I think fulfilled the podcaster's dream when we all say every couple of years, on paper, that's an upside job, you know? I mean, Vegas, fast rising population, big sports town right now. Someone could really get it going. Never happens. Mm-hmm. Never happens. Happened this year. Really fun offense. Jaden Mayava, the quarterback, backup, comes in after Doug Brumfield gets hurt early in the season, is an emerging player, one of the better quarterbacks in the country. Ricky White, the receiver from Michigan State, one of the best receivers in the country this year. We've talked about Brendan Marion, the offensive coordinator there, who has had some really good FCS coordinating results and got a group of five job here at UNLV and did really well under Barry Odom, the head coach. They have one of the best kickers in the country in Jose Pisano, who actually came over with Bobby Petrino during the 5 minutes that Petrino was at UNLV from Missouri State, became one of the best kickers in the country. And UNLV did get their asses kicked by a reduced Boise State in the conference championship game at home. But let's not lose the forest for the trees here. UNLV had a chance to win the Mountain West championship. And after what they have been through for, I don't know, their entire history as a football program, pretty impressive stuff. I don't know if it will last. You know, I'm sure that Barry Odom will be looking for other opportunities that he might be able to parlay this season into.
Vegas term parlay.
I am sure that their roster will be attempted to be picked over by Power Five programs, particularly the offense.
Alex, isn't the quarterback already in the portal? Did I miss that?
Oh my God, is he? You see, this is the thing. It's our job, and it is so hard to keep up with how many people are in the transfer portal at all times.
It's not. I tell you one thing. I'll stop you there. It's not our job to monitor 130 rosters in the portal right now. In fact, we touched on this in the show.
No, he's not in the portal. I don't. Oh wait. Yes.
Oh, he's not. Okay.
Wait. Or is he?
The
internet doesn't tell you.
The volume of players that are in the transfer portal right now from like significant places is it's just astronomical. And honestly, like. There just needs to be like a sussing out process where we can kind of figure this out after the fact. But right now, if you told me someone was in the portal, I would probably believe you.
Yes.
Short of anyone on a playoff team.
You could tell me anybody. Yes. You could tell me any non-playoff player is Florida State's like second best edge rusher is in the playoff. The portal. You could tell me any non-portal team, non-playoff team is in the portal. And you could tell me any player has extra eligibility, and
It's okay to say when you don't know something. We don't know how impactful the portal will be, at least for a couple more years. Kyle McCord's in the portal.
Kyle McCord was reported as being in the portal, and then there's been a lot of uncertainty about whether he actually is. The same is actually true of Jaden Mayava. On3Sports reported that he was, but then that report was conspicuously deleted. Let's just see where it lies.
In and of itself, that's the issue.
Right.
Yes.
Like the starting quarterback at Ohio goddamn State and UNLV, both ends, maybe in, maybe not, who knows. Stephen Godfrey, the Splitty D for Group of Five Team of the Year goes to.
I'm going to go to the Running Rebels, but I'm disappointed that neither one of you nominated Troy.
Well, Troy was going to be my nominee. If you'd have made a nominee, maybe you could have nominated Troy. I agree. They're tremendous. I think they're the best group
I'm
of five
here
team.
To tell you what's right. I'm not here to do work.
So are you usurping? Are you usurping the governmental legislative process to insert Troy?
No. I had a crazy schedule this week, so I didn't write up my nominees. I would say that Troy won 10 games in a row, won the Sun Belt again, and also was framed as, hey, there's no way a Sun Belt team, as competitive as that league is, can turn over that many starters and maintain that particular kind of identity, which was swallow you alive on defense and play and have a really good run game. And guess what? They did exactly that after they started 1-2. It was the exact same season they had last year. They lose on a Hail Mary to App. This year, they lose by like 2 points to JMU in September. So they're not, you know, typical G5 thing, right? If you're not undefeated, you're going to disappear for a while unless you make it a point to look at that league or to look at the G5. That's exactly what Troy did. They won 10 games in a row. And we just quietly went in, beat the shit out of everybody again. As for the decision here, it's hard to look at UTSA's season and not think of better previous seasons. That's the only sort of mark I had against UTSA. And I do believe in the sort of like, what do we call it? Like the podcaster's recipe of like, these things work on paper and they're appealing in a dork way. And maybe college football will then appear or work there. That's what we've been saying about Vegas and Clark County and all that for years. So I think Alex appealed to my sentimentality there.
I love that. That's a victory for my side of the ledger.
Also, just fun to watch. Just crazy fun to watch.
Richard, the play of the year in college football.
This one is, I mean, startlingly obvious. What is the play from this season that you will remember the most. It is obviously 4th and 31. Some weird shit again happened in Jordan-Hare Stadium when Auburn and Alabama play. Obviously, the prayer was against Georgia. Like, dude, it just weird shit happens in that state. I don't know how to explain it. And I believe that was the end zone that Chris Davis ran into for the end of the kick six. The prayer would have been the other end. So, yeah, yes. Man, weird stuff happens. Yes, it takes two to tango. Yes, 4th and 31 happened because Auburn does not rush three players. Yes, the kick six happened because Alabama put 1 second back on the clock. The stakes build up to it. The players, and I mean the teams here, heighten it. And then, like, dude, it's 4th and 31. Like, I don't know how, like, every year you get one of these, like, farcical, like, 4th and goal situations, right? I think, like, Louisiana Tech had one a couple years ago when it was, like, 4th and, like, what God only knows. So you always get one of these, but they never really end up in the end zone. This one did. They played the highlight of 4th and 31 on the Jumbotron, the Halo board in Atlanta before the SEC championship game. And the Alabama side went absolutely insane. So it is just a play that will live in college football lore, in my opinion, for honestly, as long as we do this. It's like, it was the last regular season SEC on CBS game and they got a classic. Like, it just, it happens, man. It was sick. And it's the thing that everybody will remember from this season. 4th and 31, my SCDE pick for play of the year.
Yeah, let's keep it moving. I agree. I was going to nominate something else, but I'm going to talk about the guy who made that play later. So let's keep it moving.
Honestly, thank you for doing that, Alex, because I see what you had in the notes and we can talk about that. We won't spoil it for the audience right now. Nope.
No, we'll talk about it
one
later.
Thing I want to point out, the only thing I want to add to what Richard just said, because it's inarguably that, there is, you can call back to it, a 4th and 20, ooh, I should know this, 3:26 play that Hugh Freeze is involved in on the losing side at Ole Miss against Arkansas. Why is that important? It was just Arkansas. That game, which Arkansas goes on to win, puts Alabama in the SEC championship and wins them a national title. Does this sound familiar? Mm-hmm. It is possible that Hugh Freeze blowing 2 4th and a country mile defensive plays could, if Alabama beats Michigan, which is entirely possible, and then beats whoever's on the other side, which is entirely possible, give Alabama 2 national titles. It is college football's version of that 28-3, but also the Malcolm Butler interception happening, like, basically in concert in terms of, you know, in the timeline, where the Patriots end up with 2 world championships out of, like, opponent brain farts. Alabama is going to be on the recipient of potentially 2 national titles because Hugh Freeze doesn't know how to, like, cover the field on 4th and 10 plus.
You will note, Godfrey, that the Patriots are only in line to get 28-3 because the NFL referees inexplicably miss on a fumble call that Miles Jack had, would have returned it into the end zone to ice the game, and the Jags would have won the AFC Championship game. I digress. Splitty-D for game of the year. My nominee, I will say, honorable mention here for Mizzou K-State earlier in the season.
Yes.
Absolute farce of an ending in a hilarious way.
Dude.
Eli Drinkwitz.
Dude, Alex. I forgot about this. All the stuff that we're talking about with Eli Drinkwitz's amazing comeback season, where he led Mizzou to the most surprising year in the SEC and came reasonably close to beating Georgia, was almost rendered null and void, in my opinion, by what almost happened back in week, I think it was 2. This was very early in the season.
Early. Yeah.
Mizzou scrambling at the end of the game against Kansas State, mountain offensive drive, and the specific particulars will elude me at the moment, but I can tell you the direction of things, which was that Drinkwitz ran a play that resulted in Mizzou losing yardage and having to rush to the line of scrimmage to kick a bomb Harrison Mevis field goal that was way harder than it had to be.
Yeah, there was some delay of game in there too. There was like a penalty that pushed them back.
Yeah, it was an absolute Mizzou fans are screaming at the car radio right now as I fumble in my brain for what exactly the situation was. But I remember the idea was long field goal, clock running. Neither of those things had to be the case. And Mivas just bailed him out with a missile from his 60. Leg.
It was like 60.
It was huge. To beat a Kansas State team that was at the time the defending and ranked Big 12 champion. So I believe they were ranked at that moment. So it was, that was a very exciting game in Columbia. But Richard, your actual nominee is Oregon, Washington, part one. Yes.
Obviously.
Yeah. Like that's the winner. But go ahead and do your thing. But that's by far the winner. It's the best game I saw all year.
Drum roll for the live orchestra. Yes. It's Oregon and Washington part one. Look, it's one of those games where you got like everything, right? You get absolute incredible setting. You get, like, this was like for all the death of the Pac-12, yada, yada, yada. This was a crown jewel game, College Game Day, yada, yada, yada. Rivals, like, and then you get, I mean, from snap one, an absolute belter, like for 60 minutes. You get Oregon in creating these like incredible high leverage situations, which is what they do, because Dan Lanning is, you know, sixth gear aggressive, using math and analytics and all that sort of stuff. So you get like a lot of high leverage plays that you know are going to end up factoring. And then you get a field goal attempt at the end, you know, to try to win the game. It was an absolutely incredible day for, and it's one of those, we talk about this. I mentioned this as a fan, a game attending fan. There are few like Saturdays better than College Game Day in the morning. You go, you have a party, and then you go to the game and your team pays it off. Like, it is so good when that happens. And I'm sure Washington fans have had better parties. The Apple Cup, you know, you won a Pac-12 championship, yada, yada, yada. Oregon, Washington part one, though, game of the year. That is the game, the full game this year that I take away before the playoff, obviously. Remembering, it was an absolutely incredible game.
It was the best Pac-12 game I've seen in years. I mean, it was the best. Yeah, it was the best home environment I've seen this season. It was the best. What did you say from snap one?
Yeah.
If you had to take a casual, an unaffiliated first timer into this sport this year and hand them a game. Maybe last year it was Alabama, Tennessee, and Knoxville, but undoubtedly this year it was Oregon, Washington, a rivalry that needs a name or a cup or something.
It's funny, Richard, that you mention the importance of the game day stage and how that can juice an environment, especially if things go well. I want to talk about a day where it juiced it and then things went poorly, which was in the second to last week of the regular season. Appalachian State 26, James Madison 23 in Harrisonburg. This was one of the biggest crowds in game day history. If the official figures are to be believed, tens of thousands of people crowded onto the lawn at JMU to host game day for, I believe, the second time at that school. JMU was in the midst of a very aggressive campaign with the NCAA, with the media, with their lawyers to gain bowl eligibility, despite the NCAA rule that was going to keep them out because of their transition up to FBS. And it was a huge party. The Dukes were rolling. They had not lost a game yet all year. And Appalachian State comes in there, kind of sits on them for a while in this game, and it looks like it's going to be kind of a boring upset. But JMU gets life late in the fourth quarter, mounts with Jordan McLeod and Elijah Surratt, like an incredible comeback drive that includes a fourth and a mile conversion, followed by a great touchdown catch, great two-point conversion to tie the game, all by the same receiver. And then App comes down and wins the game in overtime on a Caden Robinson reach for the pylon when JMU had gone up by three on the first possession, like in the first inning of overtime. And it created one of those very rare moments where they go for a review, and if he fumbled before he got to the pylon, one team wins. If he didn't fumble before he got to the pylon, the other team wins. Like, the game is over on this play, but you don't know who won. Looked at it, turned out Appalachian State won. Additional subtext was that Sean Clark was, I think it's fair to say, at that point, still a non-zero possibility to get fired. But they were also fighting for a berth, which they got in the Sun Belt Championship game. So there was just a lot happening here in this game. And I think that next to Oregon, Washington, it was probably the most straightforwardly entertaining finish to a regular season game that I saw this year. So I nominate App JMU. Godfrey, you going to be a sellout for the G5 and
I can't sell out for the G5. I mean, I've already tipped my hand here. I think it is Oregon, Washington. Although I will say, Alex, like I wish more people would go back and watch this game, because I feel like it was one of those where like everyone crowded in for game day that day. I can't remember the competing television schedule off the top of my head, but when you get into that part of the calendar, obviously P5 fans are going to kind of lock in on home team, home conference for, you know, bowl eligibility and races and all that kind of stuff. I wish more people would actually watch the game that you're talking about.
It was a good game. It was on ESPN Plus. And
that's part of the problem.
That's part of the problem. ESPN Plus.
Yeah, game day comes, but then they're like, do you want a network spot today? It's like, nope, can't have that.
Dude, I was trying to find a hockey game last night, and I'm not going to do the ESPN Plus rant for the 7,000th time, but come on, guys. At least try.
The Ndamukong Suh Award for the best player with no chance to win the Heisman Trophy on account of their positional or school situation.
My vote here for the Zony has to go to Ollie Gordon. Like it's, and we'll get to why I don't think Ollie Gordon should win this personally. Why I don't think Ollie Gordon should win this award. When we get to Alex's nomination. But let me just paint the picture here. 66.6% of Split Zone Duo LLC was ready to fire Mike Gundy after three games. Oh, he's lost a fastball. Can't do it. He's done. He's over. The goose is cooked. Cake is baked. And then your man apparently just switched things up on the fly and said, we're going to give it to number zero. And all Ollie Gordon did was go 18 for 121, 21 for 136, 29 for 168, 29 for 282, 25 for 271, 33 for 138. UCF game, we'll throw that one out. 25 for 164, 34 for 166. And then Oklahoma State's season ended after 12 games and they didn't play in the conference championship game. But be that as it may, Ollie Gordon, fantastic all season. Box office, Heisman running back numbers for like two-thirds of the season. However, I do not believe he is the rightful winner of the Ndamukong Suh Zony because of Alex's pick.
Yeah, this one is a joint pick, and you're just going to have to accept that. It's the Texas defensive tackles of Tavondre Sweat and Byron Murphy, who were more indicative of the way in which Texas changed this year than anything else that happened around that program that resulted in Texas actually being back. They had two absolute maulers at defensive tackle, also a tremendous wide receiver, apparently, in Tavondre Sweat. If you watch the Big 12 championship game that Oklahoma State fans will note did not happen because it was canceled due to a war.
Yes.
But like these two guys, what they did in particular, I think, at the end of the Kansas State game when Texas almost frittered all of this away, where they just decided, I think this was Byron Murphy specifically at the end of that game, just decided, nope, you will have no more yards. That's the end of that. but they did versions of that all year, these two guys in the middle of the Texas line, and they made an enormous difference to Texas being back where it is right now.
Hashtag Bo Davis was right. So you know what the pick is here. It's pretty obvious. The reason why I like this category so much and I like Alex's pick so much, this is what happened year after year after year at places like Alabama. The odd year that LSU would win a national title.
Yeah, Quinn and Williams, DeRon Payne. Texas didn't have these guys.
This is the difference. This is why Bo Davis was right. I mean, also, don't be laughing on the bus after you get your ass kicked by Iowa State. But this is it. It's really look, Sark is a great play caller when he's in college, your feed didn't stutter there.
Yeah.
Lined a fullback up ISO, goal to go to win a playoff game. Lined a fullback up ISO. Whew. I'll never let, dude, I'm still fighting with Bill Barnwell about that one.
I'm sure Bill's right. We can move on.
Swear to fucking God. Let me tell you something. Okay. Bill Barnwell is a Giants fan, so don't act like every decision he makes is a fucking smart one. Let me compose myself. Attacked in my own home here. That's terrible. This essentially is the difference. It's not Sark. It is recruiting. It is recruiting. I want to be careful here because if you don't have like a Texas-centric view of the University of Texas and what's going on in recruiting, always been a five-star program, right? Like, do you guys remember, and this is, I hate doing this, but like, are you guys old enough to remember when Mac would have like 16 4 and 5 stars locked up before Thanksgiving? Like, that's how Texas used to just be like, no, I'm not
no,
kidding.
No, I know. I believe. I
Texas would go out and have every sexy Ferrari skill position player in DFW, in Houston, all done. Just done.
Okay. I thought you meant something different. I was like, I thought you meant something different by lock. I thought you meant that like they had a bunch of players getting arrested. And I was like, I don't remember that. But I'm you meant
I said lock.
You said locked up. No, I thought you meant, you know, like
sorry.
Jail. Yeah. And I was like, I don't remember that being part of Texas's, you know,
lore.
Yeah, I don't remember that. But now I understand
where
what
your
mean.
Brain like where your concern goes sometimes is just all right.
I don't know. It's usually what locked up means. I don't know what to tell you.
Changing the evaluation, recruiting, and development part of this process. This has been the easiest school to understand as they've transitioned out of Tom Herman and into Steve Sarkisian, because I'm still sort of I don't know if Herman possessed the ability to change culturally what was going on at Texas. The previous guys could not either, because I don't think it's a slight against really anybody since Mac that Texas had a culture that was hard for a coaching staff to defeat, and it was entitlement. And it was also not just like on the football field. It was just like not being mean as shit and having good lines. And
they have
good lines.
I had a conversation with somebody, it was probably about a year ago, when they were like, yeah, Texas's problem is like the end look. You want to talk about pop psychology, meet a football coach, but it's,
yeah, I love that shit.
It's like, it was like the kid who goes to Austin, the kind of kid who goes to Austin.
Yeah.
Look, I don't put 100% stock in it. It is one of those things that's like, you know, a little anecdotal, a little truth, whatever, yada, yada, yada. Okay. So our Texas friends win, the splitty for the Indomitian Sioux Award. The next one, the posters post, the best take of the year. I didn't make this take this year. I made this take when it first started bubbling. But the Tyler Van Dyke stuff to me was always kind of weird. Didn't really ever really see it. And the proof, unfortunately, kind of seems to be in the pudding. He has entered the portal to the best of my ability, to the best of my knowledge. And I think SMU is the like sort of pencil in pick. We'll see. We'll see where he ends up.
Might be a good landing spot, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah.
My Alex, posters post of the year. I just want to point this out.
Yep.
I don't think that I could have been any more on the money with Colorado before the season. Like I said that they were going to be 2022 Arizona, and they were within a game of that Arizona team on record. But the point was, yeah, they're going to be a little bit more fun because they're going to have some skill guys on offense, but they're going to get absolutely caved in on the lines and they're going to be a losing team. And that occurred. So that's my posters post, my best take of the year. But don't worry, we're going to get to the worst of the year.
I'm not going to vote on this one just because I'm trying to like, I mean, it's too individual. I guess my best one was that there was this weird thing that happened down the stretch when after Washington beats Oregon for the first time, there's this idea all of a sudden because they had like the brain fart Arizona State game, I think it was, that all of a sudden, yes.
No, do it. I will not be gaslit into this. Go.
What?
Do it. Finish. Continue.
Oh, I definitely, no. Let me finish because it gets more specific. There's concerns that Washington is playing to the level of its opponent in like a dangerous way every single week after the big Oregon win, which I agreed with. Then there starts this thing in the Southeastern media specifically, and it's coming from Jaden Daniels stands that like Penix is mid.
Oh, okay. All right.
And I'm like, what? And that permeates in a way, just like I don't have like psychological data, but I'm watching the feeds and I'm watching all of our colleagues in the industry get into this Penix is mid thing, which leads into like, Oregon's going to stomp the shit out of Washington in the Pac-12 championship. I asked this on the show. I was like, why are we all thinking like this? I tweeted it. I was completely right. But the genesis of that was not Washington versus Oregon. It was that like, Penix is so overblown. He absolutely doesn't deserve to be a Heisman nominee. I'm like, what the fuck? And then they won.
I'm actually not entirely sure who's like going to win the Heisman. Right?
No,
like
me neither.
You sort of go into it where you're like, oh, he's going to win. Like, I'm not entirely sure.
Dude, I really thought that Milroe was going to get enough votes to get to New York in like third or fourth place. I'm sure he did get votes, by the way.
I mean,
but I thought he was going to get
there. I certainly don't care about that award, but it has been very funny to listen to LSU fans invoke the name Lamar Jackson and scrambling and scraping for any 2+ loss Heisman winner. man, they got their talking points down tight. Not since the two lost Les Miles 2007 BCS has LSU been this organized on a narrative.
So are you, what, Godfrey, are you breaking the tie here? Or are you letting this be a split baby?
No, I mean, I'm not gonna agree who had the better take here, because like I don't know if I can do that.
Let's move on.
I will say I remember Richard like telling everyone to tap the brakes on Tyler Van Dyke like a long ass time ago, but Alex never bought on Colorado either. So okay. I guess it's a tie.
Okay. So that brings us to the stuff.
He never bought when everybody was buying.
Okay. All right. So that brings us to the Stetson Bennett Award for worst take of the year. My splitting nominee is apparently the Colorado Bowl thing, because I still cannot believe after three games into the season, even though TCU wasn't that good, and even though they beat Colorado State, obviously in overtime, but you know, coin flip, I still really can't believe that team did not figure its way to a bowl game. Like, yes, they got smoked in some games, but like, there were other games coming down the stretch there that were one possession games. They didn't get blown out in every game. They finished 4-8. But yeah, I guess the Colorado Bowl thing, Colorado's going to make a bowl game and finish 7-ish wins, is my Stetson Bennett Award for worst take of the year on the Splitty Deeds.
Of course, the Stetson Bennett Award is named because early on in the 2021 season, some of us were quite exasperated that Georgia would turn the keys back to Stetson Bennett to play quarterback for them. And obviously it worked out fine for them that they played Stetson Bennett at quarterback.
Stetson Bennett, Kia of Dunwoody.
My Stetson Bennett Award nominee for myself is a real shame, because it would have been a Posters Post nominee, because it was this
bullshit.
Because it was a tremendous take, which I then bailed on. I laughed at you. I laughed at you both when you acted like a 12-1 SEC champion would not make the college football playoff. I laughed at you. This was back in week 4 or 5. I excoriated you on the show for being so naive to think that the committee would not put in any 12-1 SEC champion. The team that we were really talking about at the time was Georgia, but the point held and it was based on the conference. I laughed at you. Where this becomes my worst take of the year is that as the situation developed
and as it
crystallized that Alabama might have a chance to be just this team, I totally bailed. I really did not think the committee would do it. I had it and I let it slip away completely. Mm-hmm. Because I thought that the committee would be too shameless to actually, I thought that the committee would show enough shame that they would not jump a 12-1 SEC team over a 13-0 Florida State, Jordan Travis or not. And they did. But I laughed at the people who were saying things like, maybe the most rancid tweet that I've sent all year was one that was like, this imaginary scheme that people do every year where they think Alabama is going to get a jump over a more deserving team. I sent this in like 3 weeks ago. I mean, just, I hope you never send one that ages like that. I mean, it's tough. It's tough. And I have to let it stand out of Poster's honor.
You had it on the green from 20 feet with two putts to win the tournament and you three-jacked it. Unbelievable.
It's true. It's a tough situation. Unbelievable. For me. So that's the Stetson Bennett Award nominees. Godfrey, what do you got?
I thought a lot about this. It's sort of the bookend to your take, which was I don't know if it happened on the show, but it's a bit that I've worked in and out of the show before about Florida State's obsession with the SEC and Florida State's obsession and Florida State media's obsession with talking about why does everyone in the SEC chant SEC, and God, like that entire sort of the zeitgeist, like friend of the program, Bill, like Bud Elliott has always been, you know, front and center with that. But I popped Cannell pretty hard a couple of weeks ago for something. And I was just, and I think, I can't remember what the fact was, but I was like, Florida State fans are never not talking about the SEC ever.
No.
And you might have a point there, Danny Cannell, and the rest of your fucking
clip
Craven
that.
Lot.
Woo, clip dude, that.
The entire fact that school was made a hero. Do you know what it takes to make Florida State sympathetic?
Oh, I mean, quite a
it's
bit.
It's just insane. I'm still, that's the part of it I'm still thinking about days later, is like, we're all sympathetic to fucking Florida State.
Yes, quite a narrative arc for Florida State University this year, to go from like crying about the ACC TV deal, which they agreed to like,
yes,
being the big bully. They're still doing the tomahawk chop, and somehow they become the sympathetic people. Thank you to the playoff committee.
If the Seminoles are like, I think the Seminoles are making, like, the real Seminole people are making money off of it, then do what you want. But like, it's like if we all sat down here a year from now for whatever the reason, whatever the circumstances were, and we're like, you know who has a point about everything? Arkansas fans.
Yeah.
Or like, hey,
so
like,
if Bobby Petrino has a top five offense, we're gonna be we're gonna be back right here again.
Or if like Hugh Freeze has a competent season that includes like a start to finish, scandal free, like a series of logically coached games and big moments, and we're like, wow, he really pulled it together. Like that's the level that I'm sitting with, where it's like Florida State, what a sympathetic character, totally got screwed.
So you are not splitting here. You have your own. Nope. You have your own nominee. Okay.
We can all carry our crosses here.
Okay.
All right. Proof of concept of the year. Best new hire or second year coach. My option. I'm going to go off the radar here. Off the radar here and go Brent Key with Georgia Tech. Under the radar job that they have done. Bowl eligibility. Okay. 6-6. Brent Key obviously took over for Jeff Collins halfway through the year last year, got the full-time job, is an alum. Yes, that's the kind of, is an alum.
Is an alum, yes.
Yes, is an alum.
From Georgia, yeah.
And gotten them, piloted the ship there to something that looks like respectability. They gave Georgia a game, man. And I know people want to laugh at that. They gave Georgia a game there at the end. Yes, no Ladd, yes, no Brock. But yeah, man, better than they've done the last few years. So I will give Brent Key, there's something going on there. We'll see if they can kick on and find another level. But I will take Brent Key for a little bit of proof of concept, my proof of concept of the year.
Alex?
We're sticking with ACC Brents here. I think that what Brent Pry did at Virginia Tech this year, I mean, Godfrey, you can, I'm curious about this from your perspective. I think that that is like what we intended proof of concept to mean. Like, it is not proof of Virginia Tech being on the road back to being the Virginia Tech that you knew and loved in the aughts or the late 90s.
Right.
But it is proof that he has an idea about the way he wants to run his program and that that idea is on the right track. I think you have to understand that with Brent Pry, given his background, he is a good candidate to always or usually field a pretty decent defense at a place like Virginia Tech. Bud Foster demonstrated that you can do that. If you are an X's and O's guy who understands Appalachia and can get OKGs, Godfrey, our kind of guys, you can play good defense in Blacksburg, Virginia. They had been doing that, honestly, even at the end under Justin Fuente. Like, defense had been okay. It was the offense, paradoxically, that fell off a cliff in 21. But Pry immediately improved that defense's first year there in 22. And this year, again, like, had a totally respectable team on that side of the ball. And I think he almost always will. Like, he's sort of one of those head coaches who I think of in the Pat Narduzzi way, where it's like, almost always you're going to figure out defense. And, you know, despite your recruiting disadvantages, you're always going to be respectable there. And what changed was that they swapped out the quarterback, sort of because Grant Wells was hurt, and then because I think they figured out that Kyron Drones was better as the season kind of got older. Kyron Drones does something that Grant Wells doesn't do, which is he does not give the ball to the other team on a regular basis. And
he's
think
just better,
And he's also a number in the run game in a way that Grant Wells is not. And
having, and with that O-line,
I think that we are on the verge of Virginia Tech, maybe, just maybe, having a season in 2024 like Louisville just had in 2023. Like, I think that they are a good candidate to be sort of the rising ACC team of next year. If you take a look at that schedule, which I don't like to do, but I'm going to do it anyway, very, very, very light non-conference. They skip FSU. They skip Louisville. They skip Notre Dame.
Playing the schedule game.
They get Clemson at home.
See who they open up with.
To me, no reason why we cannot continue to see significant year-over-year growth, with the obvious disclaimer that it's December and the roster could fall apart before September, because that's just how it goes. in this iteration of the sport.
Okay, this is the hardest one by far. This is like a dead heat, and I'll come to a decision in a second. By the rubric that you've set out, I'm shocked one of you didn't go with Jerry Kill.
It's an excellent missing candidate, yeah.
Yeah, in terms of completely unorganized program with no resources, we're going to find an identity. They even kind of did it regionally. This is, I think, why UTEP was spurred into making a change too, of like, there's a way to coach through your problems and be like a minor key development program at this level in a talent bereft area of the Southwest. Okay. If I had to pick, without a doubt, because I think this is the hardest decision to make by far. There's a slight edge here to Key, and it's because I feel better about Pry. And I feel better about Pry for a number of reasons. One, the institution understands that how football matters, where football is in the identity, how it works complementary to the university, and how also that there is one of the things that I really like about Virginia Tech and Whit Babcock, the AD, is that it's not just a coach walking in and saying, "Guys, your history's great. We have some serious structural issues." Brent Pry said that, and Virginia Tech responded. That's what I really like about Virginia Tech moving forward. So everything Alex said is correct. And if I'm picking one of these teams to be better or the better team from 2024 to 2027, it is undoubtedly Virginia Tech, okay? But that's also kind of why I'm giving the edge to Key, because I know firsthand how fucked things are at Georgia Tech right now. I like the hire of Jay Batt as the athletic director. But this was a bridge hire, guys. We talked about this on the old Patreon episodes, on the premium episodes. I think you can still find, if you want to go through and look at the 22 cycle, where we talked about why did Georgia Tech land with Brent Key? They were so close with Willie Fritz, who obviously just got hired by Houston. And we kind of know why. Financially, it's not there. Identity-wise, it's still not there. You're sitting in the gold mine of maybe all gold mines in Atlanta recruiting right now. And I give the slight edge to Key because, one, he went in, like, talk about 22 for a second. Think about how that team, that exact roster of Jeff Collins, simplified and played up and played way above their talent level down the stretch last year. Who is it that they upset right after? I don't have the 22 schedule. Who did they upset right after the Collins was fired?
Is it Pitt? I think
he got fired after. What's that?
I think it was Pitt.
Yes. Like, they lost to UCF and Ole Miss in succession, I believe, and they fired Collins, and then all of a sudden they go into conference play, and they're like, they're not formidable, but they're better.
No, formidable is a fair word.
Okay, they're better. And I still, to this day, struggle to understand how Collins was so under. We talk about like guys playing over replacement, guys coaching over replacement. Like, is your talent, where's the talent actually executing at the level of expectation, be it recruiting star ranking, resource, whatever. And now it's impossible to say that, like, that they weren't anything other than under average, considerably so. So for Key to do that and have a bowl season is kind of a minor miracle, because Tech was such a doomed brand. And I think Jay Batt over time is going to hopefully figure some stuff out. But there's some institution side stuff at Georgia Tech where, like, I don't know if they're ever going to get what it takes. Put some finger quotes on there, to be a football program. So this was really hard. At the same time, Alex, like, man, Justin Fuente fucked up Virginia Tech badly. Like, they're still fixing high school relationships in that entire region. And your note about Appalachia is totally true, is they have someone who understands it totally and completely. Someone on Message Board Geniuses clipped a thing about UVA fans being mad that Brent Pry has a quote-unquote fake accent because he's from Buffalo originally. There was a joke in the coach's room at Vanderbilt about this, that Franklin would send Brent Pry into like Southern households because he actually had a better Southern accent than some of the Southern coaches. It's because he's a coach's kid, so he moved around a lot. That's the sort of the behind the scenes story. And I wrote about that years ago. Brent Pry, can anyone recall a coach coming into a distressed property and being like, legit, we're not even going to see results here, like in recruiting for 2 or 3 cycles? Not who the fuck says that anymore?
Not at this level.
Billy Napier.
No, yeah. So this was the hardest one by far. I probably just give it to both of them, but like, Key has the slight edge because I just think Georgia Tech is such a hard place to like just not shit your pants in public.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very fair.
I appreciate that. The final splitty to take us home here. Minority coach of the week of the year in an interesting schematic spot. Remember, minority coach of the week is not an achievement award. It's not a predictor or pretender of schematic success. It's simply just taking a coach in a certain spot and saying, huh, that's interesting. So minority coach of the week of the year in an interesting schematic spot for me goes to Fran Brown, because by God, Syracuse did it, man. Syracuse hired a black coach who is a second black coach in a row. They go black to black. The other thing is he's never called plays. I'm like 99% sure Fran Brown has never called plays as a defensive play caller. He's a DB's coach. And yes, he's been a DB's coach at Georgia the last couple of years, which means he has learned under one of the better defensive minds in the sport. A couple of them, Muschamp's on that staff as well. Glenn Schumann's a great coach. He has learned under really, really good defensive coaches, but Syracuse just did the thing. Like, Syracuse just took the shot on the guy. I'm unbelievably impressed by Wildhack and company in Syracuse administration for just doing the thing. And I think how we see Fran Brown structure this organization is going to be fascinating. You know, Brown, not just a not just a defensive backs coach, has a background in ops. Obviously, he's from the Northeast. So how this goes, I think, is going to be fascinating. And if reports are to be believed, my man is building an HBCU staff with black coaches at both coordinator spots.
Has he hired a white guy yet?
Deeper. I don't think so. So
such a shame.
Let's see it from Fran Brown. Obviously brings over Elijah Robinson, who is an absolute key add from A&M, who was the interim head coach at A&M, and who a lot of people think was really, really key to that A&M staff. And you are seeing right now who has already portaled from A&M out of their Transcendent 2023 recruiting class.
How many times have you used the phrase black to black? Because I had a thought the other day as I was staring at my phone in an airport. If I ever get hacked,
oh yeah,
I'm gonna need the hacker to know that I'm not talking to another white.
Yeah, Steve.
I might save you in my phone by ethnicity, which also would get me in trouble.
Yes,
because you're texting me things, and I'm like, yeah, absolutely, yeah, right on. And then I read it back, and I'm like, oh man, this is just so inadvertently incriminating.
Yeah, man. Stephen Godfrey is invited to the cookout, and yeah, if his iCloud ever leaks, boy.
I think a comp.
Someone else gave me cred for that. Oh, Deontay. Shout out, Deontay. I am invited to the cookout. Alex, now give the correct answer.
Well, no, I want to talk about the Fran Brown hire at Syracuse because I think it's interesting, actually. I think a comparable hire is the one that Buffalo made with Mo Linguist, which hold for a second because I realize I'm just comparing two black coaches, and so that probably looks terrible for me. Very similar region. They're about 2 hours apart. Both of them came over as DB's coaches who had not had play calling responsibilities. Now, Mo Linguist,
right,
I think, had one extra bona fide, which was that Harbaugh had just brought him in that offseason to be co-DC at Michigan, implies that you know ball, that you have FFC qualities. And I think Fran Brown, being responsible for Georgia's DBs under Kirby Smart, implies this dude probably knows a thing or two about ball as well. Hasn't worked yet at all for Buffalo. And to whatever extent you're hoping that anyone's recruiting sensibilities when they're at Georgia are going to carry over to Syracuse, obviously that's just not going to happen. But I'm excited to see, like, I think this was an interesting thing about the Buffalo hire when they hired Linguist. Like, you got a dude who, like Rich says, has not called plays, but he has been an important position coach in a complicated part of football for a while. In addition to being, I think he was like several different coaches, like Southern guy, like he was PJ Fleck's Southern guy for a minute when he was at Minnesota. I'm interested to see how that plays at Syracuse as well. I have no doubt that Fran Brown can coach some ball, because if he couldn't, I don't think Kirby would let him coach defensive backs. But it's interesting to see, like, a guy who has not had the usual path that leads to a head coaching job go to upstate New York. Is Syracuse upstate New York? Not quite. But you know what I mean? Western-ish New York.
Oh, God. Western don't say that. Don't Western say New that. York. Don't do it.
Alex.
Western New York.
They'll jump your ass.
It's Alex, Western New York.
I'm from – Alex, I live in New York City. Everything north of the Bronx is upstate. Syracuse is basically in Canada, man. Calling it upstate
it's a little more Western. They like to call it Western.
The Buffalo people, the Buffalo people are going to get mad at you. It's like West Central. I don't know. It's a big state, okay, man.
I shouldn't open this can of worms.
It's a big state.
But yeah,
all right, Alex. The real, so what's the real answer here?
Sherrone Moore now has more Big Ten regular season wins of note in his coaching career than James Franklin does.
I don't know if you're helping black people by saying this.
No, but I'll take
Sherrone Moore. He's tied with Ryan Day, I believe. If we're like, you know, he's
there you go.
And he's wait, is he? He's basically tied with Jim Harbaugh, too. if you're ranking the most consequential Big Ten coaches in big games of the last 5 years, it goes Harbaugh and Moore tied at one with two. Ryan Day also, I guess. No, Ryan Day at one. Two if you count one of his Penn State wins. James Franklin then also at one. So Sherrone Moore, I think, has already he's already demonstrated that he should be the next head coach at Michigan whenever that time comes.
We don't need to dwell on this, but well, we can dwell on it. The NFL hasn't started its cycle yet, and if they do what we think they're going to do, which is what they kind of always tease it doing, how do you not replace him at Michigan with the guy who
seems obvious, right?
Beat Ohio State in as an effective and authoritative manner in terms of like in-game adjustments and plan and da da da. Like, you have the answer in front of you.
It's going to be a fascinating month if Jim does indeed end up again flirting, which I'm not 100% sure. Less sure than I have been is actually going to happen this year.
I feel like the better chance was the two previous years.
But yes, we'll yes,
that,
I would agree.
That can also change tomorrow.
That is also the truth. That is also the truth.
Michigan's in a good place here because clearly Harbaugh can just do the NFL thing every offseason, and then when it doesn't work out, it's just like no hard feelings. Let's go win a national championship. It's a good situation for them. I'm not sure that it lasts forever that way, where you can just continue to flirt and flirt and flirt every year, but clearly it didn't hurt them two offseasons ago, and clearly it didn't hurt them one offseason ago because everything seems pretty good in the neighborhood right now. And I think it's better because you have Sherrone Moore.
I'm comfortable Godfrey giving this to Sherrone Moore. That's good. That's fine.
That's where it's going.
Congratulations to Sherrone Moore, the minority coach of the week of the year. An interesting schematic spot. Can I talk about my one actual awards vote quickly?
I'm putting you on a timer.
Okay. What's my timer? I'll make sure that I fulfill it.
You have more notes. You have more notes on your actual award vote than Richard and I have put into a doc all year.
This is true.
Probably right. Aggregate, by the way. Probably aggregate over the course of the year.
Yeah. What are we giving him, Richard? 5 minutes or 4 minutes?
4 minutes.
Make it two.
Buddy,
make it two.
2.5.
All right, 2.5.
Oh, wow. All right. Okay. Okay. All right. All right. Hang on. 2 minutes. 2 minutes and 30 seconds. Alex, explain a real vote and what it takes and how you actually formulate your choice starting now.
I hold a Biletnikoff award vote for the nation's top pass catcher. It's obvious why I would have this vote. I played receiver for many years at very high levels of football, as everyone knows, so I understand the technical aspects of the position, I would say, as well as anybody on earth. Last year, I voted for Jalin Hyatt over Marvin Harrison Jr. Felt bad about that because I thought Marvin Harrison Jr. might be the best player in college football, but Hyatt's season was just too statistically special, too special in the big spots not to give it to him. This year's ballot was, I think, even harder than last year's. The finalists were Malik Nabers, Rome Odunze, and Marvin Harrison Jr. again. Everyone, very strong case. I think if you're looking at the overall production statistically, Malik Nabers has the best case. Yards, targets, yards per target, yards per route run. He was a very efficient guy. Had some things going for him, though. He had a Heisman candidate quarterback, I think the best quarterback in the country this year. Good pass pro line. He had Brian Thomas drawing quite a bit of attention away from him in that receiving core. He did not run it up against bad teams. He sort of did against Georgia State, but that wasn't his biggest game. He balled against Alabama. He balled against Missouri. He actually struggled against Florida State in one of the worst yardage games of his season, that opener. Rome Odunze, very similar profile, also catching balls from a Heisman quarterback. Overall production in the counting stats, a little bit less, but he also had a couple guys, Jalen Polk and McMillan, kind of distracting from him. I think what really stood out about Odunze was that the numbers matched the eye test. The Biletnikoff folks give us some game tracking data that was very helpful. In contested catch rate, Rome Odunze was at 68%. Nabers and Harrison were both in the 40s. And I think that tracks with how you watch Rome Odunze. Like, he would just go up for balls. He would track them in the air and he would make incredible catch after incredible catch. Marvin Harrison Jr.'s case is obvious. He's Marvin fucking Harrison. He's, I think, the best player in the country in terms of his straightforward abilities. I think he's going to be a top NFL pick. He also did not have the kind of distractions that these guys had. And he had the worst quarterback of the three in Kyle McCord. And while Cade Stover and Emeka Ibuka are good players, Marvin Harrison Jr. was the guy. Everyone knew the ball had to go to Marvin Harrison Jr. in the key spots. What he did against Penn State, just kind of dragging that team to a win, was one of the most impressive performances in the country this year. So very, very hard pick. I agonized over it. Ultimately, I have gone with Rome Odunze for my Biletnikoff pick this year. Because of what this guy did time after time in the toughest spots of Washington season. And also honestly, because of the contested catch difference between him and the other guys.
That was loud.
He went over 100 both times against Oregon. He had two touchdowns in the Utah game when they were piddling around and they were going to lose that game. He had a buck 20 and two touchdowns in the Wazoo game. Also had the huge run on the pitch reverse to set up the winner in that game. In that driving rain in Corvallis in a game when they were underdogs and the other two receivers for Washington, Polk and McMillan, had zero catches on 8 targets. Odunze catches 2 touchdowns in the driving rain, one of them an insane catch in the corner of the end zone, tracking it like an outfielder in baseball. I think that as best we could isolate one guy's heavy lifting for the benefit of the team, it was Rome Odunze. Harrison Jr. had a great year. I have no beef with you picking him. I do think the interception against Michigan was his fault, not Kyle McCord's. Okay. And so the big moment thing that counted against him for me. Really hard pick, and I feel bad that I never voted for Marvin Harrison Jr. for the Biletnikoff, because I think he's probably the best college receiver since Larry Fitzgerald. But I spent like an hour on this. I could not get away from Rome Odunze. Thought he was the best
Alex, pick. Have you ever played D&D?
No.
You would be a fucking banger DM.
But let me tell you why I had to defend that vote is that we bitch on here a lot about people just mailing in their Heisman votes and just like looking at the stats for the quarterbacks and the winning teams. I thank you all for going with that for about 4 minutes. I just think if we're gonna come down on people for being lazy and just making narrative picks for big national awards, but we also vote, we should defend our votes. So
media shouldn't vote in anything.
In
college football.
Besides me, who should have a Heisman vote? Spencer has a Heisman vote. How do I not have a Heisman? It's unbelievable. Every year. This point will be made to the folks on Friday
when I'm
at the Heisman availability. Unbelievable. House ads.
Ask him, can I have one?
Alex Kirschner and I are wearing home field apparel for the second annual.
Don't be like this.
We bring our best. Two of us understand the moment and understand how lavish and how prestigious this podcast is. This is the most prestigious podcast we do all year. It's very important, and we bring our best. We wear our best.
I'm in a room with curtains. This is the first podcast since we started, without a doubt, since we started on video, but maybe the first podcast in 3 years, because I did not pack a home field shirt. So shop at home field. What a great fucking house ad.
The promo code is SCD20 for 20% off your first order.
I swear to God.
We're going to be with home field apparel on January 6th, 2024, in Houston, Texas, for Split Zone Duo Live, brought to you by Home Field Apparel. I'm very excited. This is, as anticipated, definitely going to be our biggest one of these events yet in terms of attendance, and also just in like what we have planned. And it's part of National Championship Weekend. It's going to be a blast. Godfrey, you're bringing some family. My parents are coming. I'm excited.
I might be bringing a lot.
I'll bring them all.
We will also we're going to have some special guests. We are going to do some things that have never been done on a live show before. If you are a Florida State fan and you would like to go to the temporary capital of our sport and maybe form an insurrection and scream stop the count,
The show is technically, I guess, on Washington, if that makes the most sense.
It is on the street wheel of Washington Ave, north of the Heights, I'm told, in Houston. SplitZoneDuoLive.com. If you are considering going, especially now, this has been asked before about the playoff teams. If my team goes, yes, we'll have a window of tickets. The rest of you, I'd buy those tickets now, honestly, because they're moving quicker than really quickest ever, honestly.
Been a little sneaky. Been like, ooh.
Yeah.
You know?
I know.
Moving product.
We're going to plug it from here on out because I think we might be able to open up some more maybe. But like, honestly, because I'm not sure of that, buy your ticket now.
There's a promo code if you're a Substack subscriber. It's on Substack.
It's in your yeah, it's in your Substack information if you are a subscriber now. And if you're if you just become a Substack subscriber at splitzoneduo.com now, you can just scroll back and get the code. It still works. I checked.
Also want to say thanks to our partners at Nokian Tires, who I believe are going to be at this event as well, and who have been tremendous supporters of ours and who also got some recognition from the state of Tennessee the other day for work they're doing to keep Tennessee green. So kudos to our pals at Nokian as well.
Yeah, seriously. Thanks, guys. Over in Dayton, Tennessee on the east side. I am in the Northeast right now. It is sort of kind of like just gently fizzing out some snow where I'm at right now. I've got to travel. I had to use a rental car the other day. I wished that I had my Nokian tires. I have Nokian on everything now.
Richard, what's it time for?
I guess, well, maybe for the last time, probably the last time.
Please don't scream it.
We won't do that. We taste it. We're tasting it. I don't know. I don't think this is.
This is the worst podcast intro in all podcasts.
Oh, we have
all of them.
Oh, I can.
There's probably some QAnon podcast right now.
I was gonna say, we can definitely.
That has a better and smarter segment intro than gently telling or screaming at people to taste it.
It's sumptuous. What can I say? Taste it. Got to.
God, I literally feel chills.
The luscious FCS
Stop
playoffs.
It.
Yeah, I want to take you on a tour of some playoff events that are happening
Alex,
right now.
Let's just skip to the fact that I know a lot of shit happened in college football last week, like a lot. And I know we're questioning the fundamental fabric of the sport.
What happened?
Okay. Dude, did anyone see this NDSU game against Montana State? Let's just talk about that.
Yeah, they survived by 1 point at Montana State last weekend. But here's the thing. With a missed PAT, I believe.
With a missed PAT to end the game.
Yeah. It's funny because I used the term that North Dakota State survived. Survive, though, almost isn't the word because there are 8 seeded teams in the 24-team FCS playoff. And the only one not to make it to the quarterfinals is Montana State, which was the seeded team against NDSU here. Like NDSU is an underdog, like was playing on the road against a seeded team in this game. It was marginally, the FCS spreads are a little weird and sometimes tough to come by, but it was at least marginally an upset for North Dakota State to win this game on the road by a point on a missed PAT in overtime. And
I've had multiple North Dakota State fans reach out in the last couple of weeks being like, how can we fix this? Like single win questions. You're still the best team in the playoffs in terms of like.
Let
me finish a sentence. God, you're like a 5-year-old sometimes. You are the best team in the playoffs as a program that understands the bracket, that has the experience, that has played on the stage more than anybody else as a 4-year class. Even right now, is this the this is arguably the worst North Dakota State team in terms of talent. I saw them play this year in person, so what's up, that they've had in 4 or 5 years. However, you got to like them in these situations. Like,
I don't know.
They're salty veterans. This is, I'm telling you, this is the annoying, they're still the annoying Alabama team that kind of sneaks into the fold.
I don't know.
His point about Bama is very well taken. Like, doesn't matter. They're there.
Yes. They have muscle memory doing this.
They are playing this week as an underdog against South Dakota on the road. Not South Dakota State, mind you. South Dakota. The Coyotes, not the Jackrabbits, who are making their third appearance in the playoffs. I think when you know FCS football is getting salty is when there are regular Dakotas rather than Dakota States that are threatening. And South Dakota is a national championship aspirant this year and has an opportunity. South Dakota State, which by the way has beaten North Dakota State 5 times in a row going back to the 2021 spring season, was 41-0 last week over Mercer from Godfrey's hometown. They host Villanova this week. They are the favorites in that game. A fun semifinal to watch here is the University of Albany against Idaho. That's at the Kibbe Dome, which is a fun, kind of a singular college football venue. It's like a basketball gym. It's a field house, but they pack it. Pretty loud crowd. I enjoyed watching the end of the game there the other night between Idaho and the Southern Illinois Salukis. For the Great Danes, they are not used to being here at all. They just beat a Richmond team that was on a big winning streak. They won the CAA, now the Coastal Athletic, for the first time since 2012. This is the deepest they've ever made it in their three playoff appearances. And Idaho themselves had not won a playoff game since 93 until they won this game against SIU the other night. Now, they were in FBS for a while, but
yeah, spoiler, why is that?
spoiler, they weren't winning a lot of playoff games or any games for a while in FBS either. So I think it's exciting that two teams in rare air in the quarterfinals, one of them is going to be in the final four of the FCS playoff bracket. Very exciting. Anyone like anything there?
It's Saturday. Ahead, NFL starts next week. Just by the way.
Yeah.
Fairly chalky so far.
Extremely chalky so far.
Honestly, if not for the Bison, would have been like, I think, almost total chalk. Like,
yep,
so
it would be the 8-seeded team. Take that for what it's worth. Yes, in the quarterfinals, if North Dakota State had not crashed the party. In the division,
it is crazy. I will say this, but this is the level in which the games start to even out and matter. Like, last week, like, I watched part of that Mercer game because I am from Macon, and like, oh my God, it's just a different football. It looked like different division teams playing each other. You will not see that this week. I think you have almost the entire sort of like class of the sport here, minus Montana State. So at least, I'm just this year, not talking about historically. So this is, I expect closer and more entertaining games this week.
In the Division II bracket, it's been all chalk to the semifinals this weekend as well. Colorado School of Mines is the top seed against Kutztown, number four. Harding is two against Lenoir Ryan, three. Harding, if you didn't know, is in Arkansas. Lenoir is in Hickory, North Carolina. Of course, Kutztown's in Eastern PA near Philly. And you know,
Lenoir Ryan, come on now.
Colorado Mines has been relevant for a while, but this is sort of maybe their moment. They're 13-0. They got to the title game last year for the first time. Ferris State absolutely destroyed them in that game. But the Ore Diggers have a shot. They are a buzzsaw. Remember that Colorado Mines got some pub like, you know, 8 to 10 years ago. They had a coach by the name of Bob Stitt who ran kind of a weird RPO-y spread offense when that was still.
Stitt happens, baby.
Yep, Stitt happens. Mm-hmm. When that was still coming up, he is long gone. He has moved on. But they are a bust.
Still the greatest tweet in all of Twitter. Anything can be confetti if you have enough dynamite.
Yes, Colorado School of Mines has said that, and the Ore Diggers are, I think, in the midst of their best season ever right now. They've got to be the favorite here. They have won games to start the playoffs, 56-10 and 38-14. But in their last couple of regular season games, the scores were 77-3 and 82-0. So Colorado School of Mines, big opportunity here. I think I'm going to root for them, and I'm going to rock my Blaster the Burrow home field t-shirt on the show next week.
I feel like they're a home field special. I feel like you more people in America have a Colorado School of Mines shirt than they do of any of the other teams competing at that level.
That's a virtual certainty. And Division III, still going on as well. North Central, that's Illinois against Wartburg from Iowa, and Cortland, New York versus Randolph-Macon in Virginia. This is North Central, the defending national champion, Stag Bowl winners, against three teams that have never, ever been here before. Cortland just beat Alma from Michigan by 17 points the week after Alma knocked out Mount Union. The Purple Raiders are the iconic program in Division III football. But they have now been dealt with, and the team that dealt with them has been dealt with. I think here we root for anybody but North Central because none of these teams have ever been here, and you root against the defending champion. We're anti-Cardinal, sorry to say.
Wow.
Are we?
What a stance. Army-Navy.
Blustery in Foxborough this weekend. Blustery.
Ugh.
Unfortunately.
I don't know why anybody does anything in New England.
Has anyone checked the vested interest on this one?
It's not Iowa stupid, but I'd fire that under, boys.
28?
28 and a half. Down to 27 and a half at most places right now. 27 and a half.
Blind under, don't care. Hit last year, don't care. Or I overhit last year, don't care. Under.
Almost never hits. Did hit last year. And Army, by the way, Godfrey, is back to playing Army ball at the end of the season. They were not doing that whole shotgunny, pitchy woo-woo thing
that Richard wrote about in the spring. I think the Foxborough thing kind of sucks, and here's why. Obviously, I don't like the Patriots, but it really has nothing to do with that. Like, Foxborough is kind of in the middle of nowhere relative to, like, downtown Boston.
Yeah, folks here, Foxborough is not, sort of explaining Boston.
That's the name of a town.
It ain't. Yeah. Foxborough is not close. We were on our summer road out. It's tough.
We stayed there this summer with the kids. We were on a road trip from near Saratoga to oh my God, Richard, help me! AAC Media Days, Rhode Island, Newport,
Rhode Island, Newport.
Yeah. In the middle of the summer when things are a little bit different and it's only extra super cold in the water. Anyway, that's the part that talks about it. When you're in Baltimore, like, the whole city feels alive. When you're in Philly, even though like the stadiums are kind of parked off to the side, it's Philly. So it, like, the energy there, like, we, I don't know, Richard, were you there? You were there that year, right? Like, it's palpable. I've done an Army Navy in Baltimore, an Army Navy in Philly. I would also say the same thing if it was in fucking Rile John. I think it's just like, I understand why they're in NFL stadiums. You would want it to be near an urban center. I think MetLife is great too. Honestly, like that's fine. They've played there as well. That's just kind of rant over. I just hate that it's out in the suburbs.
They do. They're going to go, just Godfrey, but they're going back to DC the next couple of years. Like,
sucks.
They had been like straight Philly for a while, obviously historically, and they'd sort of pepper in some DC. They're going back to both DC. Like, they're doing the Raven Stadium and the Commander Stadium the next 2 years. Then they come back to New York City and then they go back to Philly. So it's, there is a very sort of bold tradition of, like, all of the all the non-freshmen going out and getting absolutely wasted after the game.
This is why Philly is either a great or a horrendous city for this game. The most fun assignment I've ever had was, I think, in like 2017 or 18. This was the kind of story that editors were assigning in these days. I don't think we would do it now, but it was just like, oh, just go out bar hopping with the troops and just like write about Army Navy weekend. Had a very nice weekend, made friends with some families that invited me to their tailgates and things like that, and wrote about it. But Philadelphia, like the dive bar capital of humanity, is in the eye of the beholder. It is either the perfect place for this game, or if you are maybe a policymaker and you are worried about what Richard just said, maybe not a perfect place for this game, because you are never going to run out of taps in the city of Philadelphia.
I would throw Baltimore in there too. Like, I mean, you know, virtually the same city in certain
Nothing ways.
Nothing
like Philly. So. No, dude. Philly's the dive bar capital of the world.
Oh, my God. Stop I with love this. You're from Philadelphia. Pittsburgh.
Yourself. You're from Pittsburgh.
No, Jesus. I've actually Show come in. Pride. I'll tell you this, Steven. I've actually really become pro Philadelphia. I talk about this with my fiance all the time. Philadelphia has the Pittsburgh, like, nobody believes in us regional sports pride, but like the big cosmopolitan tons of like just so much stuff at all times thing, Alex, that like New Alex, York has, Alex, Alex. And it has dive bars.
I want you to take this newfound love of Philadelphia.
It's not newfound.
You can pick Pens or Steelers. Throw a kit on, as the Brits say. And I want you to go hang out in South Philly for 6 hours.
You're acting like I have not.
Put an air tag somewhere on your body, Steven, so when they throw those clothes in the dumpster,
I'm a Tony Luke
cheese steak
guy.
Retrieve your personal belongings.
I don't understand why you're acting to me like I don't understand anything about the city of Philadelphia. I mean, I've never lived there.
I walk around New Orleans sometimes, and I'm like, oh man, they do have good restaurants. And then
Alex quote on this podcast, I think, was, "I grew up in Pittsburgh, but I've never lived in Pennsylvania." I think about that. Like,
yes,
weekly.
This is everything he just said is contradictory bullshit.
What?
Well, Philly's not Pennsylvania either. Philly's close to where I'm at.
It's just as long as I've known you. Like, can we get a plate of fries for the table? You're a fucking Yinzer. Show some pride.
I my feelings about Philadelphia being a nice city are not in no way compromised by my view of my own hometown.
I'm avoiding this on behalf of Steeler Nation.
Are you making a pick here, Godfrey? By the way,
no. I'm trying to talk about the game.
No, I know.
Yeah, let's get back to it.
I said, are you making a pick here?
Jesus. That Philly thing threw me. I go to New Orleans and enjoy it sometimes, partially, although I think the city has systemic issues, and then I throw on like a Falcons t-shirt and I'm like, oh, this is why I fucking hate it. Army seniors have a chance to do something that their graduating class, so just thinking groups of four, has a chance to go out with a winning record against Navy. If that happens, it's only the third graduating class since 2000. It's been a while, boys. 2000, that's kind of crazy. Army has won 6 of 8 against Navy. They shocked everyone who pays attention to this kind of stuff when they beat Air Force in Denver by forcing, or maybe let's just say benefiting from 6 turnovers in a 23-3 win. If you ever want to see an example of turnover luck or turnover skill, fire up that game. Because like my son, one of my sons has turned into a huge Army football fan. He was watching it and he was asking, he's like, wow, we keep getting that. We keep taking the ball from them. And I'm like, let's work on that verb. As Alex alluded to earlier, Army has, that's sort of the news of this, is that Army has reverted big time in season, much more back to triple. Good statistical evidence of that. Bryson Daly has only had 16 pass attempts in their last three games, which were three wins. That gives you an idea of what they're going back to. They have a really, really solid run defense. They sort of sell out to stop the run, again, shortening possessions and doing triple-y type things. However, this is why I think, and this is when I get a feeling, you're going to see some wild and interesting pass stuff from Navy, who does run the sort of standard Kennesaw State style triple option that, you know, my beloved Georgia Southern used to run before they hired USC's head coach, just so they can go 6-6 in the FBS. Whew. Xavier Arline is the technical Navy quarterback who will start this game more than likely. He was injured against SMU. However, there have been four, count them, four Navy starting quarterbacks this year. At one point, Arline was actually a slot back. This is all leading me to believe that it's going to be a classic Army-Navy kitchen sink offensive schematic game. We've talked about this on the show before, but when these two teams play each other, they essentially go from the most reductive offenses in the world to suddenly incredibly bizarre creative flares where, and I wrote about this years ago, they will show looks in September against Conference USA teams or something, you know, or in the American, in Navy's case, and they will show a look or a tendency and run specifically only one part of that look or tendency over and over again, specifically to then add on or variation of a theme or pull it or not pull it or go into play action or whatever against the service academies, specifically these two service academies against each other. You are going to see, I would say, a healthy amount of trick plays after a low scoring amount of time, maybe something close to the half. Richard, I haven't actually looked at the weather, but like I'm near-ish right actually. Now. And like, it's going to suck. It's going to be cold, but like,
it's not gonna be that bad. No? It's actually gonna be in like 40s. Which is, yeah, it's actually okay, going to be.
I mean, sorry, seasonable. That still sucks from where I'm from. so if you're, this should be, despite all the changes in the coaching staff with Newberry at Navy, who, by the way, at 5-7 and where they started, we all watched them in week zero just get pummeled by Notre Dame. They've acquitted themselves really nicely. I think that they've proven what Army sort of like kind of bluffed at, which is you can run triple. I think a lot of the PR and messaging around what Munkin was trying to do was just that it was more for Munkin and less for the actual schematic needs of a service academy. Navy's had a very respectable first year, given that, you know, they opened with Notre Dame, they played in the American, might be sort of a sign of things to come for Army as they move over. But at 5-7, the rough look is like, give or take, they basically beat the teams they should have that were bad, and then they lost to teams that were better and more talented, roughly. I want to give credit to Navy because they didn't really shake the tree despite firing Kenny Matalolo in the locker room after the game last year. It was much more of an internal adjustment, and there was no sort of like broad sweeping change that was brought in under Newberry, which is why they hired the acting defensive coordinator. And they essentially just sort of did more interesting and different things on offense. Now, will any of this matter in a couple of years? Are both of these teams a little outmatched skill position wise going into a league like the American? Yes, I still believe that. But as far as this game goes, it's going to be another classic. They're going to mash on each other. It'll be highly emotional. You know, sing second, yeah. All that good stuff.
By the way, yeah. Commander in Chief's trophy. If Navy Army. Wins, the Commander in Chief's trophy gets shared, which means yes. That I guess Air Force retains
it. Sticks. It
which,
sticks.
Funny. Yeah. Yeah, which funny.
I hate that shit, man.
Funny enough, it doesn't really ever get shared. That's like always like a thing with three-way tie. It did a few years ago, but like it basically never gets shared. So just funny.
What I'm told is that it on the share years, nobody claimed, like nobody wants it. Highly competitive in like culture, obviously military bros, like they ain't sharing shit. They essentially act like it doesn't exist for a year. But obviously it's in play because Army beat Air Force and Air Force beat Navy. So Army can win that trophy if they win this game. But it's kind of shaping up to be very similar to last year, where Army kind of came in outmanned and outwitted a little bit and then just played the better single football game.
What do people
do? So watch out for Navy.
What do the Army and Navy fans do after the game when it's in Foxborough? Like in Philly, you go to dive bars and you go get a cheesesteak. We went to Ish Kabibbles after that game, but do they get like clam chowder?
Yeah.
What are they doing?
Yeah, you're going to have to get back to Boston, which again, it is not that close to Foxborough.
No. Like, that's what I'm saying. It sucks. Yeah, like, it sucks.
Have fun.
Boston's terrible. It's a small town.
Go Army, go Navy.
It's not so 33.3% of Splits and Duos view. Doesn't have a voting majority.
Wait, you like Boston too?
It's the end of the episode.
Oh my God. Pick a city.